Thank you very much for the invitation to be with you and to discuss with you. I believe this is my third time before this forum, and I appreciate very much to be back with you. The Middle East is in a deplorable state of affairs, more so than 10 years ago, with the sole exception of Tunisia, where democracy took hold, but where the political process is currently stuck because of political controversies. And we should not take democracy in that country for a given. It may still unravel. The Spring countries were very different. The Tunisians and the Egyptians had the common history in their lands. Libya not. Libya had been ruled by colonial powers as three provinces: Fezzan in the south, Cyrenaica in the east, Tripolitania in the west. Tunisia had a small military force, and that force was apolitical. In Egypt, the military are ruling the country politically, and the military is a big actor in the economy of the country. Tunisia was only loosely knit together by Gaddafi, only loosely because he ruled the country by means of militias, small militias scattered throughout, typically led by family members. Other countries of the Arab Spring had more coherent governance systems. And Syria had the bad fate of becoming the geopolitical epicenter of an international civil war, while Tunisia benefited very much from being at a comfortable geographical distance from the geopolitics of the region. Only Tunisia had a reasonably strong civil society. What these countries had in common was the misery. Unemployment, corruption, social and economic injustice, repression. And on top of that, rulers who had been in office for decades. Ben Ali in Tunisia, 23 years. Mubarak in Egypt, 30 years. The Assads in Syria, father and son, 40 years, Gaddafi, 42. And they were all hated. So when the street vendor, Muhammad Bouazizi in Tunisia, put himself on fire in despair over the humiliation and the harassment that he had been subject to, and Tunisians took to the streets, the scene was well prepared for a domino effect. It quickly spread to the other countries, first to Egypt. It resonated very well with the situation in other countries. It was all very, very familiar. Now, the commonality also included a lack of understanding of democratic practice, what democracy is about. To many people in the Middle East, there is no division between religion and politics. These are two entities of a seamless web. And if you see it that way, then there is no space for pluralism, for minority rights, and for rule of the people. Others have been pointing to paternalistic ruling of traditional Arab tribes and draw a line from there to the authoritarian systems of the present. There may be many other explanations also, but the long and short of it is that people in the Middle East have no experience to speak of with democracy, and naturally dictators shun education and discussion of the meaning of democracy. Still, in Egypt, the liberal educated youth who spearheaded the revolution they had a pretty good sense of what democracy was about. And many leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood actually had that also. But many of them, the best of them, were put to jail. Morsi, the Brotherhood president, had some constructive, good initiatives in the beginning. But he soon succumbed to the mentality of winner takes it all. And when Sisi hit back, then he was an easy victim. An easy victim, maybe first of all, because he had no revolutionary guard to protect himself, like the rulers in Tehran. And the military in Egypt never actually abdicated. They just bided their time. And in 2013, it was over. The military also formally took the reins. So today, the situation is worse than when the spring started. And one has to ask, was it all in vain? The answer depends on whether you look at the Arab Spring as an event or as part of a process. Certainly seen as an event, it was unsuccessful, but I would say that is the wrong perspective. The spring metaphor, Arab Spring, it dates back to 1948 when Europe had a series of revolutions, which were quelled. But from then on, democratic practice in Europe developed in fits and starts, took hold gradually, more and more. And 2011, the Arab Spring, was the result of a process that had been building up over many years. In Egypt, for instance, we talked about it well before 2011, that Egypt was like a pressure cooker. And in 2011, the lid sprang off. Today, the people in Egypt, more people than in 2011, are below the poverty line. Corruption is rampant. Political prisoners are in the tens of thousands. And there is more repression than before. Sisi's rule is harsher than Mubarak's. In that sense, the governance system in Egypt carries within it the drivers of another revolt. The French philosopher de Tocqueville once said, and he became famous for that, he said that a full-fledged dictatorship is a form of government that can be maintained over the long haul, over the decades and even centuries. But the semi-dictatorship, or when you begin to open up, that's a very difficult system to manage. Maybe the leaders in Egypt stake it on de Tocqueville's observation that he was right in what he said about the full-fledged dictatorship. But I doubt it very much, because political time flies faster these days, very much because of the communications revolution. So the leaders of Egypt today may live to be proven wrong. Again, the system has the drivers of another revolution inherent in it. Let me broaden the horizon. Zoom in on other countries in the Middle East. I pick the two most important ones, Saudi Arabia and Iran. Saudi Arabia is a peculiar political system. The royal family is in a transactional relationship with the religious establishment. The royal family funds the Wahhabists, and they give legitimacy to the royals. deeply conservative country. And I say that not only in reference to the rulers, to the royal family, but also in reference to the average citizen of Saudi Arabia. They have much to lose from another experiment, from a revolution. They are better off economically than most other people in the Middle East. And when they look around and they have seen and heard about Nasser in Egypt, Assad in Syria, Hussein, Saddam Hussein in Iraq, Gaddafi in Libya, they are not enticed to go for a revolution. The conclusion there is that it is better to live with the devil that you know, better than to stake it on the devil that you have not yet seen. The Saudi system is special, first of all, in the sense that the royal family behave as if they own the entire peninsula. The incomes, basically from oil, goes to the royal family, and the royal family pays salaries in return. Public goods, not only money, must come from the top. That's the principle, from the top down. You have all heard about the brave young women who campaigned for the right of women to drive cars. After a while, the government declared that it would be allowed for women to drive cars, whereupon they put the campaigners, the lead campaigners, in prison. And the message was quite obvious. Any good, money or public goods, must come from above. Pressures from below will not be honored. The reaction might well be prison. There has been some improvement in the field of female human rights for women, some improvements. But in the World Economic Forum's Global Gender Gap Report of 2020, Saudi Arabia is still listed as number 147 out of a total of 153 on the list. King Abdullah, who died in 214, he was a reformer. I would say that Mohammed bin Salman still has to prove it, that he is a reformer as well. In the economic field, however, he has set out to implement reforms, because the economy of Saudi Arabia, however rich Saudi Arabia has been, with low oil prices, the continuation is not so obviously good. The economy has to be based on more pillars. And hence he commissioned the report from McKinsey, referred to as Saudi Arabia 2030, in which it is emphasized that one has to encourage small and medium-sized firms, the establishment of small-sized firms throughout the country. The downside for the rulers is that if people are able to make incomes of their own, they will also naturally claim a say in public affairs. And hence, the rulers have to balance economic reform against political repression. And repression in Saudi Arabia is still very harsh, and much of it has come to the surface in connection with the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. That has earned Saudi Arabia a lot of attention, which is problematical for the leaders. One possibility remains for destabilization of Saudi Arabia? Can there be a military coup? Saudi Arabia is buying weapons, mostly from the United States, much from Europe too. Modern weapons. Saudi Arabia ranks number 5 on the list of military expenditures in the world. United States on top, of course, then China, then India, number 5. Saudi Arabia more or less on line with Russia, significantly above countries like the UK and France. And their officers are typically trained in the United States. Those who are training them would tell, however, that this is not going to be a good military force. And why not? Not because the rank-and-file soldiers are not brave, not because the Saudis are not able to organize. They have proven that they can organize. Saudi Aramco is usually, you know, perceived as one of the best run oil companies in the world. Likewise with SABIC, the chemical conglomerate, established in 82, 25 years after. Later, that company was the second largest in its field in the world. No, it is not going to be effective, the Americans would tell, because the recruitment is not by professional merit, but by birth. Members of the royal family are recruited into the uppermost echelons. And why is that? That is because of the need to minimize, you know, the possibility of a military coup. And those leaders, uppermost leaders, should not be too clever, because if, you know, clever people would grow in those positions, you know, that could again raise the probability of a military coup. So the Saudi military, it's not a good fighting force, and in their foreign policy, they are basing it on money more than on the military. There is a film called The Dissident, which is a documentary of Jamal Khashoggi, the surroundings, the ways the Saudis keep control. The repression techniques. I would recommend it. You don't find it on the Netflix, unfortunately. It will be shown in this country, in Oslo, during the Arab film days. But I'm sure that you can get hold of it somehow. There are many ways and means these days, and I hope you will do that. Iran, then. Iran is also a very peculiar political system. This system has many centers. The supreme leader, who justifies his position the way the European kingdoms used to justify theirs, kingdoms of God's grace. There is the president, the parliament, the Guardian Council, very important. 12 clerics in that council. Their task is to see to it that laws passed by the parliament are in accordance with the principles of Islam. And the Guardian Council also decides on who is allowed to run for public office. Most of the applicants are deleted, but a number, you know, passes. And then typically, when it comes to presidential elections, you might have three, four candidates. The judiciary is important in Iran, and the Revolutionary Guards certainly also. The role of the guards is to control and defend the outer perimeter of the system. You could imagine, you know, the system within a circle. The guards, they protect and control the perimeter, and inside the various power centers compete for power and influence. They typically have their own media. And that way, when meeting Iranian diplomats internationally, you meet well-trained people. They have the training from home. The experience, they have the experience and training on the home ground. Sometimes this is moving in a liberal direction, such as during the reformist president Khatami. Then came Ahmadinejad, an odd personality in Iran, I would say, a populist, a conservative in some respects, a pain in the neck for the supreme leader because he was so unpredictable. And then Rouhani, again, a move in a liberal direction. It goes a little bit back and forth, but all the time within that circle. And then people ask, is there light at the end of the tunnel? Can there be further progress? And I have to say, it doesn't look like that this is possible. There isn't much light in the tunnel, because in the other end of the tunnel, because there is no tunnel out of the circle. It is as if the Iranians are trapped within their own constitutional framework, within their own circle. And it's very hard, you know, to build, say, on the progress in terms of liberal values, human rights, democratic practice, to build on that from one president to the next. The next president will probably be a conservative, and you can only expect a move backwards for the values that we believe in and that I am talking about here. Finally, what has been the role of, and is the role of, external powers in all of this? During the Arab Spring, the United States sent the NGOs to Egypt. First of all, to Egypt to promote the values, you know, human rights, democratic practice. It seems that those who came there had not familiarized themselves with the Egyptian setting, with the landscape, and they were easy victims of the military and the deep Egypt. They were thrown out within 1 year. The NGOs were financed by the State Department. The Pentagon kept open communications lines with the military, so they played it safe. The Americans, not necessarily by design, but by, in a sense, a projection of their own system, because the State Department and the Pentagon often act separately. The European Union also got involved in the Arab Spring countries, and they had it right, the Europeans, on paper. More money for more democracy. That was the basic thinking. And they were more conscious of the internal conditions in the countries where they worked. But as is often the case with the European Union, it was in the end too little too late. It didn't make a lasting impact. I published a book called External Powers and the Arab Spring back in 2016, following developments up to and including 2014. And I wanted the title of the book to be different, Little More Than Bystanders. Publisher didn't accept that title. They wanted a more traditional one. But Little More Than Bystanders summarizes, in a sense, the role of these external powers. How is that today? Saudi Arabia interesting, again, because of Jamal Khashoggi and what that has been leading to. President Biden has used strong words about Saudi Arabia. And he has imposed sanctions on Saudi Arabians, Saudis who have been responsible, co-responsible for the murder. He has not sanctioned the MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, and he has been criticized for that, but think it over. It is very rare that you sanction the leader of another country, and especially awkward if that leader is a leader of the country, of a country with which you have a lot of business. So I think that is a little unfair to criticize him for that. President Obama also had things to say about Saudi Arabia. But the long and short of it was nevertheless that he, by all means, he didn't want to rock the boat. When King Abdullah died, he sent an historically strong delegation to the funeral. In addition to himself, Foreign Minister John Kerry, and to underline the continuity of the relationship, he also brought Condoleezza Rice and Jim Baker. He brought the head of US forces in the Middle East. He brought the chief of the CIA. And to underline that this was a bipartisan matter in the United States, close cooperation with Saudi Arabia, he also brought John McCain. I have not seen any such strong delegation sent to a funeral elsewhere. That's why I'm talking about an historically strong delegation here, again to emphasize the importance of Saudi Arabia for the United States. So what comes out of the verbal exercises that we can see these days is probably no more than ripples on the surface. It doesn't rock the fundamentals of the relationship. You may ask, why is that relationship so fundamentally important? And we might pick up on that in the Q&A, if you so want. External powers today, I've talked about the United States and the European Union. Russia tries to turn ongoing conflicts in its own favor. Currently, not only in Syria, but also in Libya. But Russia is punching above its weight. China is the biggest investor in the Middle East, and they have an obvious interest in stability to protect their investments. And they act by the UN Charter, actually, by the principles of non-interference and non-intervention. Non-interference makes access to other countries easier. Non-intervention can be used to deny Western powers legitimacy when they want to use force in the region. But none of these powers, Russia and China, are known to be supporters of democracy. So there isn't much help. To sum it up, there isn't much help to expect from external powers when it comes to democracy and human rights in the Middle East. The democracy has to come from within. And I don't think what happened in 2011 has been in vain. Some seeds have been sown, and international civil society can be enablers of more effective action in support of democratic practice in the future. They can teach, they can make the Middle Easterners understand what democracy is about. The Europeans in particular would be in a good position to do that. So in summary, I would say, please judge the Arab Spring in process terms, and not as a singular event. And if you do that, the prospect is not necessarily all bleak. There can be further progress, maybe fits and starts also in the Middle East, the way it has been in our history, European history. Thank you very much.